Hey everybody, this is Pierre Quinn and you're listening to episode number 70 of the Leading Wild Green podcast, where my mission is to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. On this episode of the podcast, my guest is writer, story branding consultant, keynote speaker, and author Matthew Loon. During our conversation, we talk about Matthew's new book, The Best Story Wins, How to Leverage Hollywood Storytelling and Business and Beyond. And we also talk about Matthew's work in some of the biggest movies you've ever heard of. So, listen up. Before we jump into the conversation with Matthew Loon, I just want to thank you, each and every one of you, want to thank you for your support of the Leading Wild Green podcast, your shares on social media, your reviews on iTunes, the comments, all of it's making a big difference. You're helping us bump up in the algorithm and share this message of leadership with the rest of the world. I want to encourage you to hop over to prcquinn.com and check out my free course, 12 Ways to Grow as a Leader, and also check out my signature course, my Leading Wild Green signature course. Both incredible value. You might want to pick those up if you want to help yourself or your team grow as you leave 2018 and go into 2019. Okay, my guest today, Matthew Loon, writer, story branding consultant, and keynote speaker, has 25 years of experience at Pixar Animation Studios with story credits that include both the Toy Story and Monsters, Inc. franchises, Finding Nemo, Up, Cars, and Ratatouille. In addition to his work in Hollywood, he helps to train CEOs, marketing teams, directors, and professionals on how to craft stories for Fortune 500 companies, Academy Award-winning movies, and corporate brands grossing billions of dollars worldwide. He's packed some incredible advice into his book, The Best Story Wins, How to Leverage Hollywood Storytelling in Business and Beyond. And we talk about Matthew's story and what it was like to grow up in a toy store. Here's my conversation with Matthew Loon. Excited to be joined on this episode of the Leading Wild Green podcast by writer and former 20-year Pixar storyteller, Matthew Loon. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
So Matthew, give us an idea, and we've heard your bio in the intro, of what it's like to grow up really in a toy store. What was that experience like?
Well, you know, I thought it was normal until I found out that other people's parents' work is, you know, teachers, contractors, doctors. You know, I grew up in a family that our family business, from my parents to my grandparents to my great-grandparents, so all my uncles and aunts, we all ran a chain of toy stores. And the chain of toy stores were owned and operated by my family. It's called Jeffrey's Toys. It still exists in San Francisco by Union Square. And, you know, I grew up in a world that was a business, but it was also a fun business. It was one that we were all about inspiring creativity and play and escape for kids and adults. And that's the world that I grew up in, which really led me to what I ended up doing as a career.
Now, there's some line of thinking, maybe a traditional line of thinking, that says, okay, you grew up in a family business that has this rich legacy that you talk about in the book. Why not stick with that family legacy? Why not make the toy store the best it could be, an international mainstay? Why pivot and go into a different direction? It's still fun, still friendly, still has an emphasis on kids, but why leaving the toy selling business to go into the world of film creation and animation?
Sure. You know, I, like most kids, I love toys. But my dad was the inspiration for me to go into a career of animation and film. My dad, like most kids, loved to draw. But he continued that passion all through high school, And even when he served in Vietnam, he drew all the time. And, you know, his dream really started aiming towards wanting to be a Disney animator. And when he came back from Vietnam and he said to his father, my grandfather, I want to be a Disney animator. I don't want to work at the toy store. That didn't go too well with my grandfather. And my grandfather, first off, said, hey, you can't make a living as a creative person. And, you know, I need help at the family store and you're next in line. And so my dad, while he loves toys, his real dream of being a Disney animator, he didn't get to do it. And then in his early 20s, he ended up having his first child. That was me. I was actually born on Father's Day. And when my dad saw that I could draw, you can imagine what happened. Mm-hmm. He instantly made a decision that you are going to live my dream. And that was me at 4 years old, already being told you're going to be a Disney animator one day. So fortunately, I did love to draw and I was creative. And so having a father who really, you know, supported this and sometimes even encouraged it too much, I ended up wanting to be a Disney animator. And in high school, I started making films. And so it was never put on to me, you need to take over the family toy store. It was, we really want you to be a Disney animator or a filmmaker. That's what happened.
So at what point did it transition for you where it was this thing that was the lifelong dream of your dad, and your dad notices this set of talents and skills and abilities in you and is pushing you to live this thing out? At what point in your career can you say that, okay, it was no longer just my dad's dream, but I embraced it wholeheartedly and it became my dream too?
Yeah, you know, I think that first it was in college. First it was in high school when I really, you know, there starts to be a little bit of that pressure of what are you going to do after high school? You know, what are you going to do for a job one day? And my answer was always, I'm going to be an animator. And, you know, my dad loved the technical part of making a film, whether it was an animated film or a live action film. What my dad really loved was the technical part, the special effects. You know, whether it was the special effects that go into an animated film or the special effects that go into making Poltergeist, he loved that part. He loved the details, the execution part. And, you know, I ended up going to a college that was in LA that was started by Walt Disney to train the next generation of animators. So right out of high school, I went to this school. I won't lie, it was a difficult school to get into. It's called CalArts, the California Institute of the Arts in Valencia, California. But I got accepted. And during that first year, it was interesting because I was focusing on learning the techniques of animating. But more and more, my friends and other people at the school would come to me for story advice. How to make my story better, more interesting, more dramatic, more funny, have better structure. And there was just something in me that was, I was able to shape stories well. And so when I got my very, very first job, which was right out of my first year of college, which was I got a job as an animator on the third season of The Simpsons. You know, my job I got was I was an animator. I was the youngest animator ever on the show. And at this point, I was really living my dad's dream. I was doing what he wanted to always do, be an animator, maybe not for Disney, though Disney owns The Simpsons now. But but while I was at The Simpsons, I ended up discovering the room where the writing team was and where they did the storyboarding, where they wrote. And I really realized that there's many aspects that make a film or a TV show, but the one that really interested me was the story part. And that was when the light bulb went on above my head of, Matthew, you know, the part you've always loved about film and TV and books and plays is the big picture. It's a story. It's what holds it all together. And so while my dad was always into the more technical part of making a film, that's when I really made it my own, where I realized I want to be a storyteller. And that was when I was 19.
And you share insights in your book, The Best Story Wins, How to Leverage Hollywood Storytelling in Business and Beyond. And you, it's just this collection of stories that come fresh.
Sure.
And live to the reader. I want to go back to being 19 and being with The Simpsons and really ask you to really tease this out for our listening audience.
Sure.
this experience that you had of drawing and then having your work redrawn in front of you. For many of us who are skilled, gifted, talented, you know, sometimes it's hard for us to take advice or even critique. What was that experience for you like? You worked hard on this and then having it redraw it in front of you.
Sure. So that is a very good question. So, you know, this, just to take you back to 1991, CG animation wasn't happening yet. CG animation was being played with, you know, for special effects and movies, but Toy Story had not come out yet. All right. Mm-hmm. And that's really was the game changer. So I was drawing, when I was at The Simpsons, I was drawing on paper. I was a 2D animator flipping paper animation. And my job was to storyboard, to animate 25 shots a week. That's pretty intense amount of work. But I had a director and I also had an assistant director. And when I would finish those 25 shots that I would animate, I hand them over to the director and the assistant director as a very green, animation guy. And they would mark it all up. There would be, you know, a whole week's worth of work. Maybe they'd like 20% of it, but wow. I'd have to redo 80%. And, you know, it's always great when you have a director who's nice about it. And they share with you, hey, look, let me share with you some of the principles of animation, or let me share how you could have done this better. And I really was eager to learn. So I was soaking it all in. But my assistant director, I won't say her name, she was a little more mean about it. Like, what are you, stupid? You don't understand this? That was a little harsh. But even though she was very harsh, I took it with a grain of salt, tried not to take it personal. But I think there's something about when you have somebody in your life, whether it's a person or a company, that you could see as a competitor or a nemesis in your life, like this assistant director, those people and those companies actually push you to want to be better. So you can either say, you know, screw this, I'm out of here. Or you can say, you know, I'm going to take this as a personal challenge. I'm going to prove it to this person. I do have what it takes. And that's what I did. That's what I've always done, is I take those people or companies who say, we've never done that before. And I want to show that it can be done and that I can do it. So that's how I've always taken those situations in my life.
How does it feel to be a part of something that when you look back on your work, you have, I'm sure, you know, untold millions, you have shaped culture, you've gotten people through difficult sections of life, your work is iconic. How does it feel when you look back, or you're watching TV and a movie that you've worked on comes on, or you're in the mall and someone has a t-shirt with a character that you helped create a story for?
Yeah.
After all these years, how does that feel?
It is still surreal. It's very bizarre. I was in India last week giving a story for business kind of keynote presentation. And everybody in India, they all know The Simpsons. They all know the Pixar films. They all love them. It is very surreal. I think the first time I experienced this was the first Simpson episode I animated on. And then a couple months later, I can watch it on TV and see my name come up. It's bizarre, but it also, after you get through the thrill of, you know, wow, I'm making stuff that the world gets to see, then there's the second layer, which is a sense of responsibility, where you realize that, the stories you're creating, that they are going to affect people in a good way or a bad way. And, you know, I think we all know those Pixar stories are more than just animated characters. They're films that communicate messages that hit us in the heart, that hit us in our soul. And you have a real sense, a feeling of responsibility to leave this world with some great stories, you know, that help people navigate their lives through love and love lost and through life and death. These are deep topics, but they really help adults and children and people all around the world. Yeah.
Why is it important, not just in the space of Hollywood and creativity, but really in all facets of life? If you're a corporate exec, if you're an elementary school teacher, if you're a fitness expert, why is it important for all of us to learn to leverage the power of story?
Well, you know, we know that storytelling works great for entertainment. We know that when we see a movie, that beyond the special effects, beyond the great actors and actresses, it's the story that holds the whole thing together. And when you have a film or a TV show that has a lousy story, it's not going to hit the numbers of the box office. It's not going to, you know, it's probably going to be a TV show that'll get canceled. But these techniques for creating a great story are not just for entertainment. They're not just for film and TV. They apply for everything. I mean, when you think about it, it can be a casual conversation with somebody over a meal, over a drink. It can be a pitch or presentation you're making for an idea, product, a service. Whoever ends up using a little bit of storytelling will stand out. And the reason why is because storytelling for entertainment or business makes information more memorable. It is scientifically proven that when you use a story to be able to share facts and figures, people are going to retain the information more. The statistic is that when you are in the business world and you share information with people, data, charts, statistics, 10 minutes later, people are only going to retain about 5% of the information. That's it. It's like we're told in school, you know, it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. But when you have a story, and in the world of business, we call it a metaphor, right? When we're able to share a complicated principle in a way that takes a personal thing that happened to us or somebody we know, and we use that metaphor to be able to explain a more complicated piece of information, people retain more. Actually, they retain 22 times more of the information. And so, when you're making a film or anything in entertainment, when you have a story around it that's working well, you transfer the plot points to memorable information. And then the other things that storytelling does is it makes information more impactful. We know that Pixar gets, put in this category of making people feel something, right? Pixar films make you cry and they make you laugh and they make you think. That's impacting your emotions. the scientific way of explaining is neurocoupling, right? It's when somebody shares a story with you and that information gets transferred over to the other person's brain. Basically, we call it putting yourself in the shoes of somebody else. So when you share a story of something that happened to you that was emotional, that impacted you, people are going to put themselves in your shoes when you tell it, and then they get to experience it. They get to have empathy for you. They get to laugh with you. It impacts your emotions. And then the third thing is when you use storytelling for business or entertainment, it makes information more personal. All of a sudden, when you use that metaphor of a moment that happened in your life, not only did it make the information more memorable, but someone just made a personal connection with you because you used something that happened to you when you were in high school or a kid to explain a more complicated business principle, but then they also make a connection with you. All of a sudden, they know where you're from, what you loved to do when you were a kid. So really what stories do is they make information more memorable, impactful, and personal. And this is not just for a great Pixar film. This is for a really great business pitch or presentation or communicating better with your team, you know? So hopefully that wasn't too long-winded, but that's what it does.
No, it was great. And what I love about your book, Masterful, because you're teaching us about these storytelling techniques, and then you're using the techniques on us as you're telling your personal story, draw us in. And you give us an example in the book of how you used it in a business context. Maybe don't tell us the full story, because I really want people to go out and buy the book. But this story of how you leverage storytelling to get a new location for the family business.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, these techniques of giving a really successful business pitch to be able to change somebody's viewpoint, to be able to, you know, move them to action. You can do that in 5 minutes. You can do it in 15 minutes. And my family's toy store has been going on for many, many years. But about 4 years ago, my dad's toy store that was in this spot in San Francisco, the landlord ended up quadrupling the lease when his lease was up. Essentially, they just wanted him to be out of the building, not because it was a toy store, but because they just wanted to probably end up selling it. And so my dad was essentially pushed out of the building, and he was going to retire. And I did say to him, Dad, because, you know, I want to keep the family toy stores going. Mm-hmm. If anything comes up, Dad, let me know, because I'd love to go in with you as a partner. And sure enough, a couple months later, he said, hey, I found a spot in San Francisco. It's perfect. Another building. It'd be great for a toy store. It's right near Union Square on Maiden Lane and Kearney Street. But the owners have already decided to put in a coffee store. Now, probably a recognizable coffee store that I won't name. And my dad said, but what if you went in and used your story powers and gave the landlord an amazing pitch that maybe would change his mind? And I'm like, Dad, come on, you know? But then I was like, wait a minute. I could do that. But before I could do the pitch, I needed to know who the landlord was. Mm-hmm. What were their likes and their dislikes? What was important to them? Now, essentially, in the world of business, this is you collecting your data, right? This is knowing what is important to your client. And I ended up finding out that this landlord, he was a fine art collector. I mean, you imagine if he owns an office building in San Francisco, he's got some money. Mm-hmm. And so his passion is collecting fine art, really old oil paintings. I love art as well. Also learned that his family had been in San Francisco for five generations. So we had a connection there because our family has been in San Francisco for that long. And then I also found out that his grandparents went to the same synagogue as my great grandparents. So I had enough, you could say, data on this landlord so that when I made a pitch to him, I shared how long we have been in San Francisco, that we love this city, that we've been here for multiple generations, that my family loves art, and that's what I ended up pursuing. You know, I took oil painting classes and animation. So what I'm doing is when I'm making the pitch, I'm using stories to be able to make connections, authentic connections, so that all of a sudden, the listener, the landlord's like, oh, here's another San Francisco family. You know, I'm connecting with him. Wow, he loves art. Whoa, he really did this for a living. Whoa, I'm really liking this guy. And then when I share how my great-grandfather was fired from his job in San Francisco because he was Jewish, then he's starting to have empathy. He's like, my family is Jewish as well. So I'm using all of these techniques to be able to create a connection. So by the end of that pitch, I won't tell you the whole story, but at the end of the pitch, the landlord changed his mind on that coffee shop and we moved in a year ago. And also, I am my dad's partner with the toy store. So the even though I still work in storytelling and writing and film on the side, I am the co-owner of Jeffrey's Toys. So I did have a part of the legacy still.
This idea of collecting data, how you did your background on this property owner. I mean, it's great work, and I think we can all apply it no matter what our field is. Talk to us about how doing research, collecting data, learning your audience can help us as leaders and creatives walk the tension between what we want to do and what other people need or what they're asking for.
Sure.
Or what even they don't know to ask for, but when we present it to them, they want it. How do we walk that tension?
So, you know, there's been many great films made that never did well in the box office. For example, The Iron Giant. The Iron Giant, directed by Brad Bird. He also directed The Incredibles. One of my favorite animated films, not a Pixar film, but it was not marketed well. They did not, Warner Brothers did not do their job with demographics and data. And really what I'm getting to is that while story is king, data and marketing is King Kong. You need to know who your audience is, or you could create an amazing story, but it doesn't land with the audience. And so when I am working on a film, like the films at Pixar, we want to know who we're trying to connect to. Now, the amazing thing is, like I mentioned, going to India, and everybody knows the Pixar films, the people know the Pixar films all over the world. And that's because we are using what we call universal themes. Themes that connect with all ages, all genders, everybody, all cultures. And these universal themes tap into our desires and fears. And this is what great storytellers and filmmakers do. The desires and fears of, we all want to belong. We don't want to be abandoned. We want safety and security for ourselves and people we love. We want to enjoy life and be spontaneous. So when we're creating a story for everybody, you want to use universal themes, broad topics. But when you want to connect with a specific audience, you do need to collect your data. You do need to know what is important to that particular audience. So when, you know, a company is wanting to make ads for DayQuil and NyQuil, they know kids are not going to buy this because that's illegal. Teenagers shouldn't buy it. That's still frowned upon. It's adults, but the specific adults is its parents. So you need to make sure you work into those ads, into that story for DayQuil and NyQuil, a story that connects with that group of parents. And that's why their taglines are, you know, moms and dads don't take sick days. They take DayQuil and NyQuil. So when we are using data in the movie business, we could be using it for wanting to know how to connect with an audience as effectively as possible. So for example, on the movie Inside Out, remember there's those emotions. There's joy, sadness, anger, fear, and disgust. Now, how did we manage to whittle down all of the emotions in life to five? And how did we succeed at making sure that all the people from the, you know, psychiatrists and psychologists and the scientific community, that they all said, okay, that works. Those five emotions, I can get behind those. It's because we had to look to the data that was collected by other psychiatrists and psychologists on what are the universal emotions all people share. And when we did this, we ended up going to, there was one guy, Paul Ekman, and Paul Ekman had studied different emotions that all people have, and there was many. But we had to start from a place of really looking at the data collected. And then there was a lot of emotions like surprise and fear. Those are two separate emotions, but they were close enough that we felt we could turn surprise and fear into one character. But this is what we'll do when we end up working on a film. We will collect our data. We will do our research to make sure that the story we're telling is believable and authentic. So it is still King Kong when it's compared to story, which is king.
Is that t-shirt available?
What t-shirt?
Stories?
Oh, no. I don't know. I have it, but that, you know, I'm sure a lot of people in data and analytics will love a shirt like that, right?
Absolutely. So I know we're about to run out of time in our conversation, but this chapter that you have on leadership, you know, this podcast is about leadership. So I had to mention this chapter in the book and the resonance, chapter six, this corollary between leadership and heroes. And there's one section of this chapter where you say that if a main character in a story stops acting or stops moving the story forward, we lose interest. And the same with leaders. If we don't keep making decisions, good or bad, you know, our companies suffer and the people that we're trying to connect to lose interest. Why is it so important in storytelling and in leadership to really keep moving, acting, or as Dory puts it, to just keep swimming?
So absolutely. I mean, we've seen that the best companies are the ones that have a leader with a clear vision, right? You know, like Steve Jobs, Walt Disney. Even when the vision of the leader gets challenged or they make mistakes like Elon Musk, it's still a clear vision. And the same thing goes with a hero in a story. The hero needs to have a goal, whether it's Nemo's father wanting to find his son. His goal is find Nemo. Right? Woody, his goal is to be there for his owner, right? That's what a toy's whole life is about, is being there for your owner. As soon as the hero loses their vision, and then they're just going through a stack of plot points or gags, we get bored really, really quick. And the reason why is because it's kind of built in our own human psyche that we see ourselves as a hero in our own lives on a journey with a set of obstacles. And we have goals that change. We have long-term goals. We have short-term goals. We have a goal of just today, I got to get a haircut, right? But there are many aspects to what make a great hero in storytelling that apply to what makes a great leader in business. And one of those number one traits is having a clear vision, pursuing that vision, and being able to share clearly what that vision is to your investors, to your team, And, you know, a lot of times people think that, you know, as a leader in business, that means you're going to succeed all the time. You're never going to stumble. You're never going to fail. That couldn't be any more far from the truth. What we love with a hero in a film is they have a vision, they have a goal, but we love seeing them facing obstacles that push them down, that knock them down, that make them stumble. But the thing we love about a hero in a film is they never give up. No matter how many times they get knocked down or they mess up themselves, they get back up and they keep fighting, they keep trying. And that's what we love when it comes to a great leader in business. And I would recommend everybody out there, go check out all those times Walt Disney failed, all those times Steve Jobs failed, Elon Musk, you know, because you'll see that even though they had challenges and obstacles, they always had a clear vision and they never gave up.
That's great stuff, Matthew. I thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Award-winning, life-changing international schedule to chat with me and share some advice with the listeners.
Sure thing.
How do we keep up with you? If we want to buy the book, I know there's how do we keep track?
Yeah, I would say the book is great because I have put my love for storytelling for film and how it connects with business into the book. The book is called The Best Story Wins, How to Leverage Hollywood Storytelling. I wanted to be fair. I would say, you know, of those examples I share in the book, yeah, about 80% are Pixar related, right? But there are a lot of examples that I share from films I love, from Raiders Lost Ark to Star Wars, and to be able to show how you can use those storytelling techniques when you want to make a successful pitch or presentation or communicate better with your team. And I have a number of different case studies in there because what I do is I work with companies as a story and branding consultant, and I share those different projects we've worked on, the ones that have succeeded, and I share the ones that have failed and what we've learned. But the book is a great read. I make it fun as well. And then I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, and I'm always sharing principles of storytelling that apply for people in filmmaking and business. So you can always find me there. And, you know, I think if you pretty much go to Matthew Lund Story, that's my website, that leads you to my Twitter and Instagram handles. So you can find them there.
And I'll make sure to put that in the show notes as well. So
sure.
People, no excuse.
Yeah. At all.
Listen, if you've never heard of Matthew before this conversation, I am 98.7% sure that you're impacted by his work, and he's continuing to make a difference through storytelling. Matthew, we wish you all the best and continued success.
Thank you.
As you keep making people cry and laugh and experience all the emotions.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for inviting me to join you today. Thank you.
Rich, rich, rich interview with Matthew Lund, talking about his experience growing up in a toy store and his journey in Hollywood, being part of some of the biggest movies you've ever heard of. And in many cases, these movies help to shape your childhood experience. So we want to thank Matthew for writing this book, The Best Story Wins. I want to encourage you to pick it up. Encourage you to check out Matthew's work on his website, MatthewLundStory.com. And we put all of his stuff in the show notes so you can be sure to have no excuse. You can find his book, you can find his work, and you can check out what Matthew is continuing to do in the space of story branding and effective storytelling. Hey, that's all I got for this episode of the Leading Wild Green podcast. Thank you for joining me today. And I want to encourage you to keep telling good stories. And until next time, take care and God bless.